From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's first Friday, February 7th, 2025. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gonna the cheese, shawa, toxic newsome, salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, seven local composers will be featured this weekend in Orpheus Project's Loco concert. We get a preview with two of the composers and artistic director, W. Todd Hunt. First Friday events abound today, including Nicole Steger being a new featured member of Juno Artist Gallery. We chat with Nicole and Jane Andreen. And it's time for another storytelling adventure with Mud Rooms, February's theme, For the Love Of. Those conversations, plus our living lands and a rich tradition, coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Cushtuk U Bill Fawcett, and the word this week is dleit.
Dleit.
That means snow. And here's a sentence. It's really snowing. Let's hear it again.
Dleit.
Snow. Gunnish Cheesh Tuchne Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation and the University of Alaska, Southeast, for this audio.
Cushtuk O Ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a Southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsihua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Occoquan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan AD have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno, Hawk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This weekend, seven local composers will feature new work during Orpheus Project's Loco concert. Performances are on Saturday and Sunday, and for more info, you can visit orpheusproject.org. And here to share more are two of the local composers, Ben Holtz and Alina Levi, along with conductor and artistic director W. Todd Hunt. Gunnar Chi, Shat Ye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have
Boston.
You all in the studio.
Great to be here.
Wasiati, how's it going?
Super. Yeah, we're tired.
Last minute rehearsals, all those things.
Seven yeah, got pieces. One more tonight, too.
Seven new pieces is a lot.
It's a lot. And there's a whole list of people who are playing here, too.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like, what, 25?
So you have like
players,
so seven
yeah.
composers.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 20-something players,
yeah.
so this is a big deal.
It's a big deal.
So
it's a very big deal.
How did this concert come about, Todd?
Well, the Conbrio Chamber Chamber Music was doing these local composer concerts, and they didn't like want to. Yeah, they kind of handed them off, and like, yeah, it'd be great. To do this, so and I thought it fits nicely into what Orpheus Project is trying to do.
I see,
and that is foster new works, and yeah, it's sort of a perfect venue for it. So we're sort of picking up.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So how did you choose the composers to be involved?
We actually put out a a spam to all of the local composers, of which there are lots.
Yes.
And ended up getting, well, eight originally, and we had to postpone one of the pieces for this weekend. Mm. So we have seven now, okay. But we did have eight pieces.
Was eight the magic number?
Eight was a good number, and it's not too long, not too short.
What is the average length of maybe, say, one of the
pieces? Oh, boy. They could be like
hour and a half.
Hour and a half. To 2 hours. But, yeah, this one won't be as long.
Oh, no. I mean of each individual piece.
Oh, God. they range from like 4 minutes and to, 12 minutes, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. So they're all fairly bite-sized.
I see. And so you are the artistic director of Orpheus Project.
Mm, yes.
And a lot of times we see you doing the conducting.
Right.
And on this, you're doing a little bit of everything.
A little bit of everything. Yeah, I'm playing and conducting. It's all chamber music, meaning that it's a small group of people playing each piece. And lots of times we don't need a conductor, but some of the pieces are quite complex, and we're also trying to put them together in a relatively short amount of time. So having a conductor is one way to get that expediency.
So you're conducting two of them.
Yeah, I'm conducting two of them.
And then you're playing in a few others.
Yeah.
And some of them, you mentioned beforehand that some of them don't need a conductor.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we just sit there, look at each other, and play, listen, and
we
do it on our own.
Do the group bob. And
the group bob.
Keep the rhythm going all together.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Who keeps the rhythm, I guess?
Yeah, it's like everybody's kind of got the responsibility.
Foot tapping.
Yeah, the whole idea of chamber music is kind of a magical thing where we can all have our own individual voice, but it is within this larger whole.
So just for those lay people like myself, chamber versus orchestra. Is it the number of people? Is it the instruments? Is it – how do define that?
Yeah, it's size for sure. Chamber meaning like a room. Mm-hmm. Like let's do this in the living room.
Mm.
Like, you know, that might be the origin of the word, I guess, of the term for chamber music is just like, you know, it's like we have dinner, let's go play some string quartets.
I see. We're going in the parlor and we're going to listen to.
Right.
Yeah, I see. All right. Yeah. So whatever you can fit
in
there.
Yeah, we're an orchestra then would not fit in a parlor.
So like Studio 2K here at KTO, I could have a chamber.
Oh, yeah.
Orchestra or chamber series in here, but I couldn't necessarily have an orchestral series.
Right. The big room downstairs?
No, here in my studio right here.
Oh, this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, this would not work for an orchestra.
we'd be squeezing people in.
Now, the big room downstairs, we've done rehearsals, orchestra rehearsals in before, and it's kind of tight.
Yeah.
No room for an audience.
Right. So what's the biggest amount of musicians on one of the pieces that we're going to be hearing this weekend?
Oh, the
Tyus piece?
That's eight people. Well, no. Yours has eight, right, Lena?
Yeah, I guess we're
right. Jim Knowles has eight. So we've got three pieces with eight people in it.
I see. Okay, that's cool.
Just kind of figured that out.
Let's get the details out there of the when, the where, and the what. I did give OrpheusProject.org where people can find out, but give me all the rundown of the details.
Right. Okay, so two performances this weekend only, Saturday at 7 and Sunday at 2, Northern Light Church downtown on 11th Street.
Okay, and of course tickets available
at OrpheusProject.org. Also at the door, but they'll be $5 more. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. So get them in advance.
Yeah.
Save yourself a coffee.
That's
basically
the cost of a coffee. Really cheap. Yeah.
Okay. So we have two of the composers in the room with us. We have Ben Holt and Alina Levi. And so I want to talk to each of you. But before we do that, I also want to shout out the other members who are composing. Lindsay Clark, right? Beth Leibowitz, Jim Knoll, can you help me with that one?
Artemio Sandoval.
Okay, Artemio Sandoval, and then Ty Wolverton.
Yes.
Okay, great. And so they'll all be playing their pieces. Are they all also playing as well?
Jim and Ty are not.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is.
Okay, cool. All right. So let's talk about this. So Alina, I know that you are you've composed in the past. This isn't your first composition. So tell us about your composing journey. When did that start for you?
So this piece in particular, I was reading a poem that my brother sent me, inspired by a piece of artwork he saw in Tbilisi, Georgia. And so there's kind of those two layers of inspiration there. He wrote poetry based on the artwork, and I wrote a piece based on his poetry, with like a flute choir in the background while the poem is mostly read and quasi-sung in some parts.
Okay, so the poem is included. But you started composing. When did you start composing?
I guess I would have started in like 2018.
Okay.
And that all kind of started because of Ben's prompting, I'd say. Like I had never really tried any of that before, and he was just very encouraging. Like, oh, write me a duet for us to play, or let's just try stuff out and kind of see what it sounds like.
I see. Okay.
He was definitely the first teacher I had.
And your main instrument is what?
Violin.
Violin is your main instrument. Mm-hmm. But you play other instruments as well?
Yep. I do viola as well. I'll be doing viola for Ty's piece, actually. And maybe a little bit of piano, too.
A little bit of piano, okay.
Just a little bit.
And what age did you start playing the violin?
I started when I was five.
Five?
Yeah, that was all I wanted for Christmas one year. And my mom scraped together the money to get me a violin. And yeah.
Wow, that's so great. And is it something that you were just – how did you first hear and know that you wanted a violin?
It's probably a story a lot of string players have in common, where I just happened to go to some orchestra concert when I was around that age and just kind of saw the instrument I wanted. And
I see. Okay. So you heard it and you saw somebody playing it and you're like, I want to do that.
Yes.
And then, of course, now lifelong obsession.
For sure.
So you learned how to play violin. And then some of these other instruments as well, understanding music. So when you decided to begin composing, what is that like versus just playing the instrument or interpreting a piece of music?
Well, my very first piece was for four violin players. So just kind of starting from an instrument that I knew best, for sure. And just, it's all experimentation. It's really just kind of trying out all these different sounds or thinking of some character in mind and pursuing like anything you'd like, and just kind of there's not really any way to go about it without just trying it and seeing what works and what doesn't.
Are you working on like telling a story through the music in some way? Because like this one, you have the poem and then also your brother's inspiration.
I would say so. Something that's really fun with like setting music around text too is what we call like word painting, where the music kind of follows the contour of what's being said. Like an example being like setting the word like up, and the music also like rises in pitch, or like also vice versa, like the word down and everything drops in pitch. Like some of those ideas.
Yeah. So secrets of the trade. I love it.
Yeah.
Cool. Did you read the poem right now? Do you have it?
That would be great. Ben putting Alina on the spot.
Yeah.
And then we're going to play a little piece of a rehearsal too. And this is it called Maze of Birches?
Yep.
Is
a Maze of Birches.
A Maze of Birches. Okay. She's looking for.
Here we go.
Okay. Let's hear the poem. Because in the music, we can't quite hear it, but it's good to hear it here. Yeah.
So this poem was written by my brother, Will Levi. It goes, "The whitened bark blocks my path, and branches skew my view. Zebra stripes make a terrible window and a worse door. As I look left to right, I see only one path ahead, an iced, slushy dirt road framed by this black-white labyrinth. To think that frost actually touched them, climbed them, bent them, loved them, and lived them, while I sit on the forest floor and weep for roads not taken, I am lost."
Okay. That's awesome. And that's called A Maze of Birches?
Yes.
Okay. And the piece is also called A Maze of Birches. Awesome. I guess if brother and sister write it, then they can have the same title, right?
Yeah. So, he said it was okay.
He gave you permission.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a listen. This is it's just a couple minutes. It's from a rehearsal. Is that what this is?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that you recorded. And it'll give you a sense of the music. You can hear somebody talking in the background a little bit, but you can't quite hear that. But let's take a listen to it right now. A Maze of Birches by Alina Levi. That's just a little bit of A Maze of Birches, a rehearsal that you were going through in terms of hearing it. Was that like one of the first times you heard it being played through?
One of the first, yeah.
Yeah, it's so interesting when you compose it on paper and then to see it like fleshed out. And but that'll be a piece that'll be happening this weekend at the Loco concert, which is pretty awesome from Orpheus Project. And also, thank you so much, Alina. That was really lovely.
Thank you.
And Ben Holtz, you have a piece that is also, we don't have any audio for your piece, but tell us a little bit about what it is that we're going to be hearing from you this weekend.
So I think this is six movements from a 12-part series. It kind of goes back to an early lesson from a composition teacher I had in college about nothing being harder than starting with a blank slate. And if you can kind of constrain yourself or give yourself a bunch of rules, and the creativity can really come out in having to work inside that framework. Like that's kind of when things blossom. So the series is called Sketches on Simplicity. And it's something that I've kind of picked away at since then, which was probably 12 years ago.
Wow.
You know, I think the original intent was, oh, this semester I'll write 12, you know, one in each key. And I got two done then and, you know, maybe two more in like 2018, 2019. And then this one is number six and just finished. So we'll be hearing six of those on this concert.
Wow, that's pretty cool. And sort of same question for you is in terms of, you know, playing, what's your main instrument?
Cello and piano are kind of my main
instruments. Cello and piano, okay. Yeah. And then when you work on composing, how does your mind think in cello and piano first and then you sort of adapt, or what do you do?
I would say it's a very different, you know, cello is a very kind of technical almost. It's more like my engineering brain, I guess, like very mathy and very, you know, technique and, you know, getting the best sound all comes down to some kind of a technique or structural thing that you're doing. But with composition, it's more like starting with a slab of clay and building it into something. And, you know, like you might not like it and so you throw it out and you start with a new piece, or, you know, you kind of start to shape it and then you can put some more detail in it. So they're, for me, they're two very different mind frames. But the having played cello and piano, it kind of informs, you know, it lets you understand how each of the instruments work. You know, it's almost like you're kind of practicing making the paint, and then now's your chance to paint with the paint.
That's so fantastic. Yeah, that's really cool. And I love the idea of sort of, I guess, starting with, you know, the constraint and trying to figure out what is inside that. And, you know, that's kind of fun. Sketches in simplicity. I love that. That's going to be great. And how's rehearsals going for you?
It's great. So.
And then next year we hear the other six pieces. Because there'll be more. People will want the sequel, right?
The quartet has been very patient, because I think yesterday was the first time they saw it actually finished to the very end. So.
I see, right. Well, that's the beauty of new work, right?
Right?
It changes up until the last moments.
It's a lot of beauty there,
and rehearsals can change things, and hearing musicians play it, and then you go, oh, well, maybe I want to mix these other two things. And so the creative process, right, which is just fantastic.
Yep.
So, well, thank you all, Gunnith Cheech, for being in here today to tell us a little bit about this concert happening. It's Orpheus Project's Loco Concert. It's happening downtown at the Northern Light United Church. It is seven new compositions, and you'll be doing Saturday night at 7 and then Sunday at 2.
Right.
Yeah, okay, great.
Yes.
Two performances there, and of course you can find information and get the full list of all the artists that we mentioned here on the show and get tickets and all that at orpheusproject.org. Did we miss anything?
I don't think so.
Oh, well, get back to rehearsal then.
All right. Yeah, we got to go.
Gunnith Cheech for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks, Boston.
Nicole Steger is the featured artist at Juno Artist Gallery for the month of February. We talk with Nicole and Jane Andreen next here on Juno Afternoon from KTOO. But first, this week's episode of Our Living Lands.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The devastation in and around Los Angeles is a reminder that extreme wildfires burn year-round. That's why the Washoe Tribe of Nevada and California is working to reintroduce intentional cultural fire meant to restore forest health. In the first installment of a three-part series on indigenous fire, the Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
It's a sun-splashed afternoon in a forest near South Lake Tahoe, where large fir and pine trees stretch into the clear blue sky. Here, there are dozens of tribal members eager to learn about cultural burning. But first, they have to learn how to control and put out fires. That's why a group is huddled around a heavy-duty water pump with two thick fire hoses connected to it. One is in a tub of water, the size of an above-ground pool, and the other is unraveled a few dozen yards away. Jeremy Miles Placencia is with the U.S. Forest Service and leading the demonstration.
We have everything connected. We have our discharge hose. Now we can set up the fuel line.
And then he revs up the water pump. Water pushes through the extended hose like a snake coming to life. Now participants can practice spraying pressurized water as if they were putting out a fire. One person soaking up that knowledge is 30-year-old Kyle Tabor Cooper. He's a member of the Nooksack tribe in Washington State, but lives in northern Nevada and is engaged to a member of the Washoe tribe.
I've met a lot of people that have inspired me to like get into this training and just show me like a different kind of way, like with cultural intentional fire.
Cultural fires are restorative, not destructive. They're typically done on a smaller scale to take care of traditional medicine plants or other cultural resources that rely on fire.
So for example, the Washoe tribe, our first two burns were burning a willow patch.
That's Rihanna Jones, the director of the Washoe tribe's Environmental Protection Department.
Washoes are famous for their baskets, making beautiful baskets. So when you burn the willows, they grow back better, straighter, with less secondary nodes.
But the Washoe tribe wasn't allowed to burn for more than a century. That's because of longtime colonial federal policies that prioritize suppression or putting out fires as soon as they start. Jones says that has hurt tribes and the health of many forests.
Fire suppression is like an indigenous culture and indigenous people suppression as well. You know, they were not interested in, I think, learning from indigenous people.
But that has started to change over the last decade. Now, many federal fire officials say decades of keeping fire off the land caused a buildup of highly flammable dead trees and brush, turning many forests into a tinderbox. And rising temperatures and drier conditions are adding even more fuel. A 2021 study led by UCLA found that climate change has been the main driver of the increase of fire weather in the West.
Climate change has had a huge effect with respect to drought, increase of pests and pathogens, and then increase of wildfire. So we're having these catastrophic huge wildfires coming through that we can't keep up with.
Global nonprofit The Nature Conservancy has worked with tribes to help restore that balance. The group brings together trained burn bosses and indigenous fire practitioners to work and learn side by side. Brandon Cobb is Cherokee and a program manager with the conservation group, which was here at this training.
A lot of what we're doing here is trying to return to that different style of fire that allows us to actually promote our ecosystems, promote our cultures.
He says that's why it's important that younger generations become educated and trained on stewarding their homelands.
As indigenous people, it took almost 500 years to nearly eradicate us. And in order to rebuild to what we once were, it will take at least 500 years.
Back near the water pump, Tabor Cooper is motivated to be a part of that change.
I feel like there's a lot of purpose in this kind of line of work.
Through this hands-on training, Tabor Cooper gained qualifications to fight fires with federal and state agencies and the Washoe tribe, and work on cultural burns with tribal members. He's already gotten a taste of what it's like. He recently observed a cultural burn in a meadow to restore medicinal plants like elderberries, an experience that inspired him even more.
The possibilities and like the opportunity and like what the future holds like seems so much brighter. Introducing a relationship with fire that isn't just bad.
Tabor Cooper says he's excited to carve out a career in fire and pass that knowledge down to future generations. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Caleb Radel.
Next week, you'll hear about a tribe working to build its capacity to conduct burns on their ancestral lands. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. Today is First Friday with events all around town. For a full listing, you can head over to jahc.org, and they will have the listing of everything going on around the town. And one such opening is at Juno Artist Gallery at 175 South Franklin Street, whose featured artist of the month is Nicole Steger. I'm joined now by Nicole, as well as Juno Artist Gallery's Jane Andrine. Gwyneth Chi, Shatye Adi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio today. Wasa Iti, how's it going?
Hey, thanks, Boston. It's really a delight to be here. And it's really a delight to be here with Nicole, who is our featured artist and our most recent photographer to join the gallery.
I love it. That's so great. And you have a show opening in about an hour, which is kind of cool. So, Nicole, you are one of the newest members, as Jane said, of the Juno Artist Gallery. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey and why you wanted to become a member of JAG?
Well, I've been doing some wildlife photography for a couple of years now, maybe a handful, and I just wanted to be able to share it, make a little money off of it, afford all these lenses I drool over.
I see. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, so making some money and being able to pay for your habit.
Yes, it's an expensive one.
Yeah. So you're saying that photography came into your life only a few years ago? Or
No, I've always loved it since I was very small. I got my first Kodak 110 film or 110 millimeter film camera. Mm. From my dad, probably 5 years old, and I used to set my dolls up and all of our animals and take pictures and run to 1 hour photo and get them all developed. But then when in high school, in ninth grade, we had a photography class that I took all 4 years of photography. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, and my an aunt gave me her old SLR, a Minolta, and just kind of took off from there. I kind of always known that's what I wanted to do.
That's awesome. So it just it sort of started as a child, and here you are.
Yeah, wildlife is definitely new. During COVID, when we all got trapped in the house, looking out the window, you know, I had some hummingbirds, and I was like, oh, I should get my camera down and go take some photos. And then it just reignited that spark. So. Mm. And then I've met up with a couple local photographers that have been really helpful in introducing me to the wildlife genre and all the different settings and locations around town.
What is the things that you have to do that is for wildlife photography that's a little bit different from maybe taking pictures of dollhouses and things like that?
Well, wildlife, you're just totally immersed. You have to just be ready. You have to know your subject, how fast they move, their habits, behaviors, and just sit and wait and anticipate and be ready with my settings in the right where I want them to be, you know, what I'm trying to capture. Do I want to capture the essence of movement, like a blurred motion, or do I want to, you know, stop action? So I have to just, you know, think about those things.
So there's a lot of preparation.
I suppose so, but it comes fast in my head. Uh-huh. Yeah. I just kind of look at a scene and I think, what do I want to do with this? And I just do it.
Do you know, like, when you're, let's say, like, one of the pictures I know that you sent us is a hummingbird. Mm-hmm. And I'm imagining that you can't get too close to them because they're going to fly away probably. So do you have to have a certain kind of lens when you know you're going to go out shooting hummingbirds versus some other kind of wildlife?
Yeah. I do it in my backyard, and I actually have a 200 to 400 millimeter. So it's a zoom lens, and I set it up on a tripod. Mm. And I decide where do I want this light to hit it. I'm a big fan of backlighting, as you can see from that. And it's just light. Wings are all illuminated.
I love it.
Thank you. So I look at the lighting and I look at the background and I think, where do I want to capture this hummingbird?
So you know what time of day it is. Yeah, and you can be like, I'm going to be over here so that I can get that backlight.
Yeah.
I see. And then how much... do you do after you take the photo in terms of are you like versed in one of those programs that you can change the coloring, or do you modify it in any way?
I like to try to keep it as real as possible. I just use Adobe Lightroom. Mm-hmm. I don't really know anything about Photoshop. That's just too much. But Lightroom allows me to, you know, bring up the exposure or lift shadows, because I shoot pretty dark. Mm. I like to save my highlights, and then you have to bring it up in post.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Yeah. And then some of the other photos I'll post these on our website so people can take a look at it in advance before they head down. They might be heading down tonight, but also the show will be up for the whole month, right? You'll have the wall down there at Juno Artist Gallery, and people can see this stuff. There's a lovely picture of an owl at the top of some sort of tree branch, I guess.
Like a spruce tip, I think.
Yeah, spruce tip, which is kind of beautiful.
Northern pygmy owl.
And it's like, so this one, it has the owl sort of in the foreground, and the background is blurred. Is that something that you did with the camera, or is that something you do after?
No, that's based on my aperture settings, how wide my aperture is open, and it was all the way open. And I positioned myself for that photo. It was in a tree. And to the left of me, I saw another tree, and I saw an opening, and I positioned myself in such a way that I was like, this owl has got to go land there. Please, God, make him land there. And then he landed there.
Oh, that's so nice.
And yeah, and so I took the shot, and then I kind of moved my body, and a few inches makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with that one, and it's just tree leaves and stuff with that blur out because of my wide aperture.
I see. Yeah. And then there's another one of an owl. Is that the same owl?
Which one?
It's this.
Oh, yeah. That's a short-eared owl, and I was belly-crawled to that one.
Yeah, it looks like you're on the ground for sure.
Yeah, I was belly-crawled to that one in the snow, and That one, that was so much fun. I was actually on the phone with Jane when I was taking that.
I didn't know.
She called me for something, and I said, I am with an owl, and I'm getting the most amazing shot. I'll call you that.
That's so funny. And then this other one that I have, this is just gorgeous. And talk about the use of backlighting and all of that kind of thing. This has some wonderful lighting in it. And what did you call this? Your
This is my ballerina swan, I call it.
Yeah, ballerina swan.
Yeah, I really love capturing animals, especially birds, in like beautiful poses. I love to freeze them in a pose that people normally wouldn't associate with. When you just, the average viewer of birds wouldn't
right.
see that. But that was a funny one because I was actually taking my dog for a walk. And I always bring my camera with me. And she's a bird dog. And she was 70 pounds at the time. And I hooked her to my waist because I saw these swans. And I saw the light glistening off the water. And it was, this was actually midday sun, which is really challenging to get. And so she was yanking on me and barking at the swan, and the swan couldn't care less. And
that's so funny.
Like, please calm down. And I just cranked my shutter up and hope for the best for this one because my dog was yanking on me so much.
Wow. Well, it's gorgeous. And of course, these all these are available for purchase, right?
Yeah, most of them. Yeah, I've got to print some more off, but yeah. There's only so much room.
Right. There's only so much room you can fit in down there. But you have your own section now at the Juno Artist Gallery.
I do.
Which is fantastic. You're going to be there tonight. We talked about kind of some of the work that will be featured. It's your photography, your wildlife photography. You'll be on hand from 4:30 to 7:30 tonight to do a meet and greet, which will be nice. And there'll be other members, I'm sure, milling about the space, right, Jane?
Yes.
Yeah.
We always like to have a handful of us that are there talking and greeting and sharing information. And anybody who wants to come down and talk to us about becoming a member, we have some space, and we are really interested in getting additional artists into the gallery.
Yeah, I know. We talked about that, I think, a month or so ago in terms of how the spaces work, and that you have spaces available, and that people who are interested, like Nicole, who has you just recently joined, right?
Yeah, I really did love the gallery since I've moved here.
Yeah.
If I had nothing else to do, I'd just go in there just to look and take it all in.
Well, now you can. Yeah. You're a member.
Yes.
That's wonderful. So if you are interested in becoming a member, of course, you can go down and speak with anybody who's down there. Tonight, who's working at the gallery? It is a cooperative of, is it about 20 people now?
I think it's right around, just a little bit more maybe than 20. It's kind of seems like it's a floating number. So 20-ish is a good number.
20-ish. Mm-hmm. And it is a cooperative. Everybody takes a turn working in the store, but also gets a space to put their wares out and what they have available. And it ranges from photography to all kinds of art. I mean, just anything you can think of that's artwork is down at the Juno Artist Gallery.
Yes, yes,
which
absolutely.
Is fantastic. So head on down there in about less than an hour now to meet Nicole and see her photography. And it'll be up all month. And, of course, you can find out more about what's going on with Juno Artist Gallery at junoartistgallery.org. What a pleasure to hear about this work, and congratulations on becoming a member and these fantastic photos.
Thank you.
And let's help you pay for some of those lenses.
Yes.
Because they're expensive, right?
Yes.
The lenses ain't cheap.
No.
And you probably always have your eye on a new one that you want.
Always. I'm like, what can I do with that one?
That's so funny. Well, I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Boston.
Us.
Thank you. Gonna cheese. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. Wanted to mention that tonight's fireside chat at Mendenhall Glacier is about the 1908 Star of Bengal sinking near the southeast shore of Coronation Island here in Alaska. The ship carried 106 cannery workers, 36 crew, and a cargo of over 52,000 cases of canned salmon. According to some sources, the cannery workers were locked in the ship's hold and thus condemned to sure death. Other accounts denied this and emphasized the crew's efforts to save all aboard. What really happened on that fateful day? Can maritime technology shed light on this tragedy and help heal century-old wounds? Join maritime archaeologist Jenya Enichchenko to learn about ongoing research and past and future fieldwork tonight at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Also, tomorrow begins AARP Tax Aid every Saturday and Monday through April 7th at St. Paul Catholic Church. Assistance is by appointment only. To schedule an appointment, visit www.aarpfoundation.org/taxaid. A-I-D-E. This is a free community service. It requires no AARP membership, age, or income requirement. And again, a rundown of all of tonight's First Friday activities and events can be found at jahc.org. Up next, Mud Rooms, the storytelling event, is back next Tuesday with a February theme, For the Love of, just in time for Valentine's Day. And speaking of amazing storytellers, here's A Rich Tradition featuring Maya Angelou. This is Juno Afternoon from KTOO.
For A Rich Tradition, I'm Yosef Surrett. Today, Maya Angelou speaks.
There is a true yearning to respond to the singing river and the wise rock. So say the Asian, the Hispanic, the Jew, the African, the Native American, the Sioux, the Catholic, the Muslim, the French, the Greek, the Irish, the rabbi, the priest, the sheik, the gay, the straight, the preacher, the privileged, the homeless, the teacher. They all hear the speaking of the tree. They hear the first and last of every tree speak to humankind today. Come to me. Here, beside the river, plant yourself beside the river. Each of you, descendant of some past-owned traveler, has been paid for. You who gave me my first name, you Pawnee, Apache, Seneca, you Cherokee Nation, who rested with me, then forced on bloody feet, left me to the employment of other seekers, desperate for gain, starving for gold. You, the Turk, the Arab, the Swede, the German, the Eskimo, the Scot. You, the Ashanti, the Yoruba, the crew, bought, sold, stolen, arriving on a nightmare, praying for a dream. Here, root yourselves beside me. I am that tree planted by the river, which will not be moved. I, the rock, I, the river, I, the tree, I am yours. Your passages have been paid. Lift up your faces. You have a piercing need for this bright morning dawning for you. History, despite its wrenching pain, cannot be unlived. But if faced with courage, need not be lived again.
I'm Yosef Surrett from Columbia University's Faculty of Religion and African American Studies.
A Rich Tradition was produced by Jim Luce in partnership with WCSU-FM. In Wilberforce, Ohio.
AAPRC, the African American Public Radio Consortium.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. Seven storytellers, 7 minutes, $7. All for a good cause. Mudrooms is back this month with a new storytelling event, and it's a good cause for the Kin Support Program. Welcome now to the studio, Taylor Beard, board member from Mudrooms, and Holly Handler, co-director of the Kin Support Program. Gunath Chi Shayadi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you in the studio. Wasa Iati, how's it going?
I would say it's going pretty good.
All right.
It's at least sunny.
Hi, Taylor. It's nice to see you. And hi, Holly. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you.
Excellent. Okay. So let's get the details out of the way. Taylor, tell us when, where, what, and who.
So it's going to be on Tuesday, February 11th at 7 p.m. That's this next Tuesday coming up. It's at Kunikiri Northern Lights Church down here in the flats. And the theme is going to be For the Love Of. Our musician for the show is Sunny Porch.
Love Sunny Porch.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, they are fantastic.
They are wonderful.
Yeah, because
it's
I'm thinking
of the singer for some reason.
We have talked about that when they were in here performing because it was like, it sounds like somebody's name. It's actually the name of the band, but it's pretty great. Yeah, they're fantastic. And that's a good warm-up because I'm sure they're going to be performing at Folk Fest again this year, which is really cool. So For the Love Of, obviously we think about February and we think about Valentine's Day and we think For the Love Of, but what I love about your title is it's For the Love Of ...
Right.
Which means it doesn't necessarily have to be all that happy.
It doesn't. Of the stories that I've heard so far, because we had our rehearsal on Thursday, I would say that there's going to be enough that are not necessarily about love in the immediate context. So, and they're all great stories. So.
Right.
Yeah, we try to leave all of our themes open so that it can be really flexible and mean anything. But yeah, I mean, I feel like my mother's favorite phrase when I was growing up was "For the love of God."
Right.
So, you know, and not in the like yay praise way. Like you just did something seriously stupid, Taylor, and now I'm going to point this out by saying "For the love of God." So
I also think of "For the love of Pete."
For the love of Pete.
I don't know Pete is, but...
It's like, who is Pete? Pete's sakes, all the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Pete's sakes. Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
No, there's For the Love of Pete. There's totally For the Love of Pete.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So who are the... Do we know who the storytellers are? Do we want to shout them out?
We do. We have Brett Bennett, Karina Lorenzi, Isla Lund, Bonnie Chaney, Leslie Wood, Maddie Koch. I think I said that right. Koch.
K-O-C-H?
K-O-K.
O-K-O-K. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I should have clarified that. Maddie, I'm so sorry. I should have clarified this ahead of time. It's been a long week. Yeah. And so we have Susan Johnson. And then as a backup, just in case anybody can't make it, because it is that wonderful time of year where people get sick, we have B.G. Loper. And he will be telling a story. If he doesn't tell it this month, he will tell it next month. And his is an excellent story. So,
I mean,
they're all excellent stories. I'm very, very excited.
And are we expecting coffee and cookies and all those good things?
Oh, yes. Coffee and cookies from Copa. And where else? I should know this. We get coffee and cookies from two places, and my brain just went dead.
Do you get them from the Rookery still?
Yes, the Rookery. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for saving me on that.
They have that. One of my favorite cookies I've ever had, the cornflake chocolate chip cookie.
Oh, they're so good. Yeah.
They're so good.
They're so good. So bring extra cash to make nice big donations for cookies.
And you prefer cash at the door, right?
We do prefer cash at the door. I think we only take cash at the door. Like this last time when we did the Smut Room show at the Crystal, we did Venmo because a lot of people coming to the Crystal don't think to bring cash. They just bring their credit card. But we definitely prefer cash at the door. So.
And this is not the last Mudrooms of the year.
It is not. There is one next month also.
There's one in March.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that will be the last one. Okay.
That will be the last one.
I see. And what's the theme for that one?
I should know this.
I stumped Taylor.
Yeah, you just stumped me. Give me a second. I'm going to look it up. It might be first-timers, yeah.
First-timers? Yeah. Holly knows. Yeah, because you're probably also on the beneficiary for that month too. Yeah.
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 Oh, that's right. That's right. Thank you.
Yeah. There we go.
I was like, I think I got all the information I need, and clearly I did not.
It's all good, because there's a lot going on in the world right now. So, the fact that we get to go to Mudrooms and have a good time and turn our brain off and just listen to some fun stories is going to be a wonderful Tuesday night.
It is going to be a wonderful Tuesday night. And I mean, and in that same vein, like I would say several people are probably considering getting into politics, and if you're wondering if you can slog it, come tell a story with us, because that is a great way to figure out if you can publicly speak.
Because you're always looking for stories.
We're always looking for storytellers.
Right,
yeah.
So there's always a need for storytellers. Are you full for March?
Not quite full for March yet.
Okay. So
we do need a few more.
And what's the best way for people to reach out to become a storyteller?
So they can reach out to us via the email, but there is also a link on our website to click on that, and then you can sign up to be a storyteller. That's the storyteller form. So
there's
that way. Yeah. But if you happen to know who the board members are and see us out in public and want to approach us and say, hey, I'd like to tell a story, we are happy to talk to you that way too. So
I see. Okay.
Yeah. I'm never going to be like, I don't talk to people I don't know.
Right. Because you're always looking for storytellers.
We're always looking
for
storytellers.
You never know who's going to be a storyteller. Okay. And then the cool thing about Mudrooms, which you can find out all this information at mudrooms.org is the main website. And the awesome thing about Mudrooms is that none of the money goes to anybody but the beneficiary, right? To pay for the rent of the space, of course, but then also anything, all the proceeds go directly
to the beneficiary.
To the beneficiary. And for the next couple, I guess, it's going to be the Kin Support Program that Holly Handler is involved in. So, Holly, tell us about the Kin Support Program.
Sure. We're so appreciative to the Mudrooms Board for giving us a chance to be the beneficiary for February and March, because we are a brand new program. We opened our doors in July. We're an independent nonprofit, and we are here to help family members who are raising their little relatives and are doing that outside the foster care system. So we work throughout the Southeast region. We've got two amazing family specialists, Vanessa George and Lenora Walker. I help with legal matters for kin providers, and then we work with an attorney who works with parents. So we're trying to be holistic and work intergenerationally and try to keep kids healthy and stable and out of the system.
And so what does that look like? What's like the daily work that you all do?
So families can just call our office or send us an email. And we've all worked in the nonprofit sector for a number of years, so as a result of that, we've done away with the application forms and all the barriers. There's no financial screening. It's just if you're anyone who's raising a child in the Southeast region, or if you're a parent who's looking for some advice, or if you're an older youth and you're looking to connect with your relatives, we can just help with a phone call. And so people might need financial help. They might need legal help. They might need to figure out what kind of therapeutic resources are available, and then we're developing some cultural programming to help with healing through that.
Oh, wow.
Method.
That's so great. And, of course, let me give the website for you, southeastkin.org.
Southeastkin.org. Right?
And that has the phone number and all that good stuff, and an email probably or a contact page to reach out.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a new organization. So how did it begin? The people, obviously you were involved in the creation of this. Was it you talking with your colleagues and saying, hey, this is a space that is needed in Juneau?
Yeah, there's just five of us. We're small but mighty. And we've all worked in the nonprofit social services sector. And we just saw all these grandmas, grandpas, uncles, aunties raising kids without a lot of support because they were doing it on their own through families they had just created out of need. And we saw in other communities that they've got these great kinship navigator programs. And we thought, you know, we really need one of those in Southeast. So we started one.
Yeah. Wow. So you came together. And how do you begin that journey in terms of startup, like in terms of making the startup happen? What did you rent office space? You know, I'm just curious about the business side of creating something like this cool adventure that you're doing.
Yeah, we talked to a lot of our partners. So a lot of it was listening to partner agencies, listening to people that we know have been raising little ones and trying to figure out what it is that they wish they would have had when they started on that journey, and what they'd like now for folks who are still on that journey. And we did a lot of fundraising, grant writing. But of course, events like this with Mudrooms is a huge shot in the arm to us. Yeah, because there's never enough fundraising that nonprofits can do, especially in this particular time in our history.
And getting the word out, you know, that you're around. And so what kinds of issues or what kinds of needs do you, like an example of something that might come up for somebody that the Kinship Navigator program can help with?
Sure. There is one case that our awesome family specialist, Lenora, worked on where Grandma was raising two of her little kids in one of our smaller rural communities, and this young kid, not quite a teenager, you know, was a growing boy, and she was figuring out how to get all the kids' needs met, but this kiddo had size 14 feet.
And she was just
struggling to keep this kid in shoes.
Mm-hmm.
So she was trying to figure out the resources for that and kept hitting all these dead ends.
Mm.
So Lenora did a bunch of research on her own, figured out what was available to help her, helped her with applications, and by golly, she helped get those kids his shoes.
Yeah, I think I was 13 or 14, and I had a growth spurt, and I ended up with size 15 shoe. Let me tell you, you go to the stores, and you can't get them.
Yeah.
You can't get them. You have to order online pretty much. But back in the day, there wasn't that option when I was a youth person. And, like, even in a small town like this, you really don't get those sizes available.
Right.
Like, they usually stop at 13. And so, wow, that's a cool thing.
Yeah.
So if people, and this is open to anybody.
Right. Yeah. So we don't do any financial screening. It's open to anybody in Southeast. And yeah, any generation can apply, kids or parents or caregivers.
I love that. That is so cool.
Yeah.
And you also have a Thlinkit name for the organization.
Yeah. Our Thlinkit name is Hayat Husani, which means our precious children.
Ah. Yeah, see, I wondered what that was. That's really nice.
Yeah, when you guys came up as a beneficiary, none of us had heard of you. And we had a lot of beneficiary applications in front of us. And I was like, this looks like a very serious need in the community. You know, like my kids go to Kakadu Waheen.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, as you're talking, I'm like, I have no doubt that there are people at that school who would benefit from your organization. And so, yeah, we were very pleased to be able to give you guys the beneficiary spot because it just sounds like such a great organization.
Yeah, it's a really good fit for the community. It's brand new. Mm-hmm. Just started last July, as Holly said. It's really fantastic. You can find out more by going to southeastkin.org. It's the Kin Support Program. It's a kinship navigator program serving Southeast Alaska kin families outside of the foster care system. Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us, Holly.
Thanks,
and, of course, Mudrooms is supporting the Kin Support Program for the next two Mudrooms, the last two of the year. Give us the time and date one more time.
It is Tuesday night at Kunikiti Northern Lights Church at 7 p.m., and it sounds like we should try to pack the church as much as we can to get as many people in so that this great organization gets as much money as they can for these kiddos.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so good. And of course, you can find out more and get more information for next month or sign up to be a storyteller at mudrooms.org. Holly Taylor, thank you so much. Gunnath Cheese for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Really appreciate it. Do it for this week's Juno Afternoon. Next week, a rainy day conversation with author Awen Ivey about her new book and more. Plus, Elizabeth Baratchevich Day, a sneak peek at the JEDC Innovation Summit, and more. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. The show is sponsored in part by Heritage Coffee and Hanson Grass. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunnath Cheesh, and have a joyous Juno weekend.